Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, the podcast where we talk about faith, finance, and everyday life in a way that makes total sense. I'm your host, Alexis Busetti. On this podcast, you'll hear the personal stories of friends I'll be interviewing who are doing familiar things in new and innovative ways. We'll answer questions specifically about money and our relationship with it, and we'll explore faith and Bible teaching together. In all of these, it's not about changing our convictions as much as it is about messing with our methods. We'll have a lot of moments here together where we pause, then say, that makes total sense. Hi, I'm Alexis Busetti, and welcome to That Makes Total Sense. I am so excited to bring you this conversation today with Dr. Christina Crenshaw. Christina currently is a full-time lecturer at Baylor University, where, among other topics, she teaches on faith and writing and leadership inside the church and other vocations. Christina has also done extensive research writing and speaking on human trafficking. And it is that arena of human trafficking that we used in our conversation as the narrative, kind of steering where we wanted to go in this larger conversation of social justice inside an even larger context of biblical justice. So I think that you will really enjoy this conversation. One of the things that Christina has given to me is language surrounding this topic of justice, because if you're anything like me, I've been interested in this topic of justice since I was a kid. But if we focus on it only in a humanistic standpoint, we really miss the bigger picture of what God offers all of humanity through the gospel. So I really think you're going to enjoy this conversation with today with Dr. Christina Crenshaw. Hi, welcome to That Makes Total Sense. I am Alexis Busetti, and I am so happy to bring today Dr. Christina Crenshaw from Baylor University. Hey, Christina.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh my goodness, it is such a joy on my end. So Christina is, I'm going to let her give you her story in just a moment, and we're going to kind of talk through this idea of biblical justice, which I would say up front, she and I are both saying we're not experts in the field. I would say she is much more an expert than me, but we're going to try and talk through this partially through this narrative of Christina's involvement with the human trafficking world and how she got into that, and kind of using that as a narrative to look at this lens of justice, specifically in America, but around the world and through a gospel-centered lens. And so I actually want to just say, since we're not going to be focusing completely on trafficking, maybe we can get together and put together some links that we can put in the show notes for people who are more interested in that. I know you probably have a lot of resources. I have done an interview with Annie Lobert. I don't know if I told you that, mm-hmm. A Pickers for Jesus. And then we've probably both got some books and some resources that we'll throw out there if this kind of wets your whistle and you want to learn more about that trafficking. Christina's done some writing on that as well. But that's going to be kind of her narrative, because that's how she was really introduced to this and a world of justice and what does that look like to be gospel-centered in justice. So is that an okay place to start?
That is a great place to start, yes.
All right. So why don't you tell us first what you do for work, kind of where you're living, where you've been bunkering, maybe is a good question since we're in the middle of quarantine or at the tail end of quarantine here in Texas.
Yes, yes. So I live in Waco, Texas. My husband and I affectionately like to say that we liked Waco before it was cool to like
Waco.
Right. My husband did his MBA at Baylor, and then I did my PhD at Baylor, and we moved to California, and I taught as an assistant professor of English and education at California Baptist University, and he was working in the business world. So we were out there for several years, which is when I, got interested in doing anti-trafficking work. We can talk a little bit more about that later. But then we ended up really feeling called back to Texas once we had two kids within 21 months.
Whoa.
And yeah, while I was on a tenure track. Wow. And he was, you know, running hard and working. And we just did really, we didn't have great community, as San Diego is a really big city. And it's community is spread out and we didn't have any family. So we prayed about it and we both laid down our dream jobs and we came back to Waco, Texas. To be closer to family who live in Dallas-Fort Worth and really just to have a healthy family-centric environment to raise our kids. We knew that we'd have a good church. Baylor was gracious to make a full-time lecture position available to me.
Wow.
So I was able to really still live out the things that I felt called to do. It was, I mean, as far as higher ed is concerned, a demotion and title, but I think spiritually it was a real promotion and win for our family.
Wow.
And my husband has been fortunate enough to find great work. He does home health care and manages several offices and directs them, owns a few throughout the country. He oversees 27. So most are in Texas, but some are Florida, Nebraska, but anyway, we do that through, or here in Waco, Texas, and that's where we live.
I love it. I love it that you loved Waco before loving Waco was cool, because
yes.
Loving Waco now is super cool.
Yeah.
You know, when I grew up in Southern Oklahoma and went to Sunday school with this like Baylor Bear family, uh-huh. Right? And
yeah.
So the only thing I knew of Waco back way, way back when was this Baylor Bear family, this in my little Southern Baptist church, every child grew up and went to Baylor.
Went to Baylor.
And it was
yeah.
super fabulous. And so whenever the youngest, who was my age, when she was gone, you knew that she was visiting her brother or her sister in Baylor for the weekend. And then sadly, the next thing we knew about Baylor, or about Waco, was Branch Davidian, you know, when that mm-hmm. happened. But I had never been to Baylor. Or I had never been to Waco in real life, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm, ever. Mm-hmm. And I was driving back. Actually, we can talk about that. I was driving back from a Propel conference that was in Dallas a few months ago. And I ended up leaving early, just wanted to get home. And I told my husband, I think I'm going to stop and have lunch in Waco. Like mm-hmm. I can take that route home. And I have to tell you, it was insane. Like it was insane because I'm driving through and I'm like, I know what a Texas, Oklahoma college town looks like. We were in Norman for, you know, 10 years. And mm-hmm. I was like, this is not like Norman does not have people on golf carts selling brochures for tourism in their yeah. downtown. It's crazy. So I yeah. love that you loved Waco before loving Waco was cool. Because
yes, but I do want to say Magnolia has been really redemptive for the city's reputation. And we love that. Chip mm-hmm. and Joanna are amazing people. So we're thankful. They've been really redemptive for Waco. We get about 30,000 visitors a week, or at least we did pre-quarantine. We'll see.
Pre-quarantine. That's so sad. But it was beautiful. I will, you know, I went on Magnolia and walked the grounds, and I have some dietary issues. And so I don't know why I actually anticipated I'd be able to eat in downtown Texas town. But anyway, I ended up grabbing chicken on the way out. But it was fun. It was super fun to stretch my legs and walk mm-hmm. around. And it was beautiful and great. And so I love that you say that it was redemptive, because I think mm-hmm. Even that is going to be kind of a thread that mm-hmm. we'll see throughout our conversation. And I love that word. I love the meaning. When I had the chance to talk to Annie about her experience with trafficking, that was what kept coming. That's the theme that kept coming up over and over and over
again,
is redemption. And so, so let's back up to California when you guys were there and you kind of first got introduced, at least on a formal level, to human trafficking and what that meant. Can you take us back there?
Sure. Yeah. So when I went out to California, I was, you know, fresh out of finishing my PhD program. My dissertation was actually on how the Christian worldview makes us agents of change. Essentially, this argument and this call to action that if you are a believer, whatever sphere of life you go into, business, education, the arts, the sciences, you have this calling inside of you, this mandate on your life. It's written on your your heart to do justice. And it's the Christian worldview that really is a call to do this unto the Lord. So I had already written a dissertation. It was primarily on the Christian worldview, but then like secondary on how the Christian worldview, I mean, because the Christian worldview in and of itself is this redemptive, beautiful story. But really, I think sometimes the church misses the call to action in the Christian worldview. And, you know, there was this understanding after writing the dissertation that this is what makes us agents of change. This is why we are set apart from people who are doing justice, but not necessarily doing it from a biblical worldview. So it just was the Lord's timing that when I went to California, I ended up getting connected to the A21 campaign. Our church here in Waco had relationship with that organization and helped them write and do some standards alignment with their Bodies Are Not Commodities curriculum. Mm-hmm. And that's a high school curriculum for educating students on what human trafficking is, how to be part of the solution, that sort of thing. So, you know, human trafficking is one of those issues that once you know, you cannot unknow. You know, it's a modern day slavery. It's an injustice. I think, you know, we can talk too, later about the tense race relationships that we're experiencing right now, in our country and how, you know, evident that a conversation around that is an ongoing conversation is needed. So I think similarly to like the nation being woke to this tension between races, you know, this was a time about, you know, 7 years ago, six, 7 years ago when the nation was really becoming woke to this idea of trafficking. And the church was realizing this is an opportunity for us to step in and make wrong things right, which is really the definition of justice. You know, justice is to look at something that is broken and to want to make it right again. And so I think that was like a foray into, okay, the lens that I apply to life matters in the outcome. It matters in the eternal. And so I started getting involved with anti-trafficking work. And I would say that is sort of like my call, my cause, if you will. But I do think that some of the things that I have learned from doing anti-trafficking work are transferable to any call or cause that somebody may be called to. So I started doing anti-trafficking work when I was out in California, and we moved back to Texas. I just jumped right into what our church here in Waco was doing. There's a great organization here called Unbound, and they do wonderful work. And then we have a great human trafficking coalition. And then from there, just kind of went to Baylor and said, okay, here are the few talents that I've been given and my sphere of influence. And I'd like to take this and give it to you as an offering. Can we please do some research around this? There is a lack of research, particularly within prevention education, or at least there definitely was 5 years ago. There's been more that's emerged since then. So we did this really robust study with 200 students in the area and, did some reliability and transferability studies on it, T-tests, ANOVA, to see if this curriculum, the A21 curriculum, was really working. And in a nutshell, we saw gains. There were significant gains in some areas and small gains in others. But after being exposed to curriculum, we saw, okay, this is working. It's raising awareness. It's giving them terms and language. It's giving them a place to report things that they didn't know before. And again, I feel like that was something that I did not because I was just compelled by society to make broken things right. That is part of the narrative, but the full narrative around that was this is a mandate from God. This is an invitation from God to partner with Him on things that are already on His heart. So I think that's just kind of one of those places where I've realized the Lord is evident and moving and present and near to the brokenhearted. And it's so beautiful that He invites us to partner with that.
Oh, it's amazing. And I love two of the things that you said just really stuck out to me. And, you know, one of them is seeing something. Like one, I agree with you 100%. Human trafficking. I remember a few years ago, I did a Dressember campaign and I cried almost every day because I'm telling my husband, I don't know what to do. You know, I'm like, I'm doing this. I don't know what to do. I have seen this and I can't unsee it. but I don't really know what to do. And I think that's something that a lot of people, believers, especially sometimes, I think we sometimes feel that way. Like we feel like we see something, but we don't really know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm seeing that. I'm sure you're seeing that too. You know, you mentioned the racial tensions that are happening right now. Ahmaud Arbery's, and there was an arrest, two arrests made last night, yeah. Which is kind of the breaking news in that story. But it's like I think a lot of us, I'm seeing a lot of responses from people that I respect saying, I've seen this and I don't know what to do. And so with human trafficking, that was one of the first places as an adult with children, I think that, that I really felt that in my own life of, I see this and I understand at least what I can wrap my mind around, that it's a really, really heartbreaking, huge worldwide big deal. I don't know what to do about it. But the second thing that kind of stuck out to me is part of, I feel like the catalyst for showing us what to do and having some action is what you said you guys recognized in that study is it gives terms and language. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so important. That's actually one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast is because you helped give me terms and language for this kind of compelling to justice that I have felt almost my whole life, but not wanting to do justice for the sake of justice alone. Yeah. But you're helping to give me vocabulary, helping to give me terms and language surrounding that. And I feel like that's kind of step zero in some ways toward action is I don't know what to do, partially because I don't know what I'm seeing, partially because I don't know what that's called. I've never had anyone call it anything before, but if I can hear and relate to what it's called, then I can formulate a response better in my mind, right? Like when we call human trafficking slavery, I can formulate that in my mind and that helps me respond. When I heard you say bodies are not commodities, I have language for that now. Mm-hmm. I understand a bit better and that intrigues me to want to learn more because that terminology triggers something in my mind. And it makes me want to learn more so that I can know more, so that I can act better. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's kind of like a progression for me. Does that progression ring true in any way in a formal, sense or in an educated sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't know that I necessarily know the educational psychology behind that layering or that schema that, but there is this connection, you know, between having language and being able to articulate that. And then I think the call of action that naturally follows. And I think even just looking back over my own life, I can see how I to back up even before my dissertation as a doctoral student at Baylor, I taught a social issues and education course. And I taught that for several semesters. And so we went over things like, you know, racial tensions, socioeconomic status, things that are affecting kids' education. We even talked very, very slightly about, you know, gender identity in classes, but, you know, gender inequity, and that's a different conversation for a different day. But in that, I can see how the Lord was already planting these seeds of understanding justice. As we're reading Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is I hesitate to say a controversial book, but it is sort of a more left-leaning book, but you know, there are great teachings in there nonetheless. I want to add that little caveat, but I'm a big fan of Cornel West, bell hooks. So again, within education, these are pretty cornerstone people. I would say within church conversation, they can be slightly controversial, but in that I say, I am of the mind that I want to read the gamut. I want to read everything that is, you know, very church-centered, Christian worldview. And then, and I would say that those, the people that I, the aforementioned people would consider themselves believers, you know, Cornel West, particularly, but, I don't know about the others, but, it gives me a holistic picture and understanding of what, culture says about justice, but even then like God's response to that, because I'm able to then sift and say, okay, when I take this Christian worldview and I apply it to other things that I am learning, where do I see truths aligning? And when, where do I see a departure? And I can say, I'm actually not going to partner with that philosophy or that line of thought. But anyway, teaching this course, I think, planted that seed for justice. Understanding how my Christian worldview influences my call to justice, getting involved with anti-trafficking work, and sort of here we are 10 years later, I can look back. It really has been a whole decade since I graduated, almost a decade with my PhD program. And I can see sort of that natural progression of, okay, Lord, you were working all along, you know, and I can't wait to see, you know, 10 years from now, what the Lord does with that understanding. I always get really leery of people who have like made it and arrived at their thought and this is their stance and they're not moving in it. You know, you don't want your absolute truths and cornerstones to change, but I think your perspective has to be a little malleable because life changes and conversations mm-hmm. change and we get new evidence and we have new, you know, terms or new places of understanding. So I think that's an exciting place about the Lord is that he, you know, he is in culture and he relates to culture without ever changing who he is as sovereign God. You know, those truths don't change, but it's amazing when you look at what faith looks like in an American culture, or you've gone to, you know, a third world country or to Europe, the places of ministry or the places of justice or the places where God is moving look different because it is, it's got to, you know, sort of like find a place within that culture. And I think that's true, you know, with justice as well.
Right. That's so good. And take us now from reading to writing, because I'm kind of hoping we can use the, kind of the, your call to your students in your faith and writing class as kind of a springboard for continuing that conversation on social justice and biblical justice and what that looks like. But we've talked a lot about Christian worldview, and you have a faith and writing class that is just mm-hmm. so intriguing to me. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit about how you challenge your students. First of all, maybe what you see in them when they first begin this class and how you challenge them to shift their writing and their perspective when they're taking this class.
Yeah, so a little bit of context for that. Incoming students take a writing class, all incoming Baylor students, very few place out of it. And they can choose between five themes. And I'm not sure what all the themes are. There's one actually like on food taxonomy. I'm not sure what students are interested in that, but there is one. There's one on technology. That's a popular one. There's one on happiness. And then I think probably the most popular one, and there's a few of us who teach it, is faith and writing. Not all of the students who come into my class are believers or, you know, walking with the Lord. So I get the gamut of students who come into the class. And I always kind of give them a heads up on the first day, like, this is not a Bible study. And this is just an opportunity for you to explore the sacred in whatever way you want to. And I do have some students who come in and they want to look at other faiths, you know, Islam, they want to look at, you know, or even what it means to be agnostic and to still do good works. And so I want to create a sacred space for them to do that. That being said, the vast majority come in and they have some sort of a Judeo-Christian background, and they are interested in looking at how their faith influences the way that they see life, the way that they engage with the world, you know, whether that's leadership or servanthood, and then the way that they do justice. And so they write three different papers and they're all written from a different style, like a rhetorical analysis, a Rogerian paper, and Toulmin. I'll spare you the nuances of that writing. But essentially all of it is looking at argument, putting it in conversation, and then them coming up with their own position in a nutshell. And what we do is I have had them read some Timothy Keller books, like they have read Generous Justice, but mostly it's excerpts. So they'll read some excerpts from C.S. Lewis, a lot of Christianity Today articles, because those are short enough that they can do their reading, come to class ready to do conversation. One of the things I do as an educator, and I've had students point this out by the end of the semester, and they'll say, you know, if the sort of ethos of the classroom that day leans more conservative, then suddenly I become a little bit more liberal in my question. Sure. Yeah. But vice versa, if right. we have some, you know, a student who is just, you know, outspoken and kind of, you know, leaning a little bit more like left or liberal in their perspective, then suddenly I become a little bit more conservative because I'm trying to bring a balance. It, sure. You know, I keep telling them, like, we're not going to solve these social issues of human trafficking and abortion and, you know, all of these other race tensions, all these other contention topics in a first year writing course. If our leaders cannot figure it out, then we're probably not going to solve it here. However, my heart and my goal for you is for you to encounter the tension and then to ask, what is God's heart in this? You know, broadly macro level, but micro level for you. What is your calling today, tomorrow, in engaging this issue, you know, whatever the issue on the table is. It's really just giving them, like, again, tools and language for how do I come back? And we mentioned this in our conversation earlier, but the Christian worldview is essentially creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. And so when we look at that and we apply that to different social issues or different places of justice, we can then get a better grasp. We can glean a better understanding of God's heart for justice, because we ask ourselves, in this brokenness, do I see a place for redemption and restoration? Because that is God's heart every single time. He is near to the brokenhearted, and he wants to be justice and be mercy to people who don't have that. And so again, you know, we get to partner with God in doing that. He doesn't need us, but what a beautiful invitation that he, you know, wants to use us. That's kind of what we do in the class. It really, it's a writing class, but I would say even more than being a writing class or a research class, you know, like the subtitle is like thinking, writing, and researching. But it really is, it's a thinking class. I want my students to leave transformed, whether that's sort of like this micro transformation or it's a complete metamorphosis, you know, which honestly rarely happens. But if they can leave the class saying, okay, I have learned to consider the oppositional perspective and to find some validity or to find some truths in that, and then to really reconcile that with what I know God says and his perspective, then that's a win for me. You know, if they glean some other things like MLA or how to write a coherent thesis statement, then that's great too. But my real hope for them is that they have learned how to apply a Christian worldview to different contexts so that will serve them well throughout life.
Right. And that's, I love that you brought that whole background, because I think it's really important. And one of the things when we chatted previous to recording was, you talked about the Christian worldview, but like the difference between kind of making that your lens versus, I think what oftentimes, you know, I had kind of joked with you in one of our previous conversations of like, if you're 20 and you don't have something that you're like, you know, going to go to the stake for, you're not 20, like you're not a college student, right? Like it's just, and yeah. So I had those things for sure that I'm like, I'm going to die on this mountain. But a lot of times they were cherry picked or like, I'm going to, you know, trust God or look at this or really, really focus in on this one aspect of justice or wrong or something like that versus what does the world view? Like, what does my worldview say about that? I don't know. Can you unpack that part just a little bit? Kind of this lensing versus, I think you called it cafeteria picking.
Yes. So, and I'm not really sure where I first heard this. I can't completely claim ownership over it, but this idea of cafeteria Christianity, where we get our tray and we go through the line, we're like, I'll take some of this. And it's just sort of like, a side dish to whatever our main dish is.
Right.
And I think, you know, using that same analogy, you want your faith to be the main dish. But what I tell my students, and again, and I admit, I sort of give them this caveat. I say, you know, this is really more of a theory and a philosophy. I don't have a 12-step program for how to implement this, but it is a shift in the way that you think and you see life. But I read in grad school a book called The Labyrinth by Comenius. And so this is really, really good. This analogy, but he talks a lot about putting on a lens through which you see life. So putting on glasses, like, you know, that you see differently. If you put on sunglasses and your life is shaded, if you have on different prescription glasses, depending on the prescription, you're going to see things differently. So when you put on this faith lens, or when you put on this like justice, faith and justice lens, you know, how does that then influence the way that you see life? So even though, you know, my sort of niche is really with anti-trafficking work, it absolutely affects the way I see homelessness or hunger or domestic abuse, right? Because I understand now, wait, these are all places of brokenness, a result of the fall, a result of just inequities in society. And I don't have the answer to fix all of them, but I do understand that I am called to play a part in bringing redemption and restoration where I can. And so again, I think it's just this place of understanding, like, I'm not just going to cherry pick my causes or to say, you know, that you know, I'm a professor and I do some human trafficking on the side, or I do some faith things on the side. No, faith is the catalyst. It's the impetus for why I do everything. It's the impetus for how I mother. It's the impetus for how I lead or serve. I'm always going back to what is God's heart on this. And I would say that's really, in a nutshell, what separates this idea of social justice, which again is not wrong. That is a real buzz term in certain circles.
Oh, say that again, because it just cut out. You said it really separates. And then we lost it.
Okay.
So sorry, can you say that sentence again?
Yeah, so I think what really separates the idea of social justice from biblical justice is understanding that social justice is where we start, but it doesn't end with doing good works unto society. That biblical justice looks at God's heart for society and has eternal perspective on that. And so again, if you follow the threads, like, you're going to get different conversations from that. And it, you know, it can be, social justice can be a role buzzword, positively or negatively, depending on what circles you are in. But I would say that that is part of the narrative. But for believers, the complete narrative is that it was God's idea to do justice long before it was our modern day contemporary society's idea. You know, that it was God's heart to take care of the widow and the orphan and the least of these long before it was a compelling narrative in the contemporary. So, right. Yeah. So again, I think it's that place of almost redeeming justice. I don't know if that is a book, but it kind of ought to be.
Like, ooh, it kind of ought to be.
I know.
I wish you'd write that. I wish you would write that. It's so good, but it's giving me the picture of, like, I have observed, and I have been friends with, and probably especially in my early 20s, I have been that person who, because I think it's a temptation for believers, because we seek these things out. We say, God loves the orphan and the widow, true religion, right? True and undefiled religion. Mm-hmm. And we kind of wave that banner, you know, from that verse from James. And then whatever it is, I have seen it, and I've seen it in me. And I think it's a temptation for many of us who have that bent, is to make that thing, that cause, whatever it is, our main dish, as you would say, mm-hmm. like our pet cause. And so right. instead, and I think that when we do that, oftentimes we don't realize that becomes our lens eventually.
Mm-hmm. Or even worse, our idol.
Oh, I mean, I wish you would preach on that. I mean, it does. It mm-hmm. can become that. And the idea that social justice or any of these causes is an incomplete narrative for the believer, I think, is so important. And I do think that the language surrounding this is important. I mentioned to you before when we were connecting that one of the reasons that I wanted to have this conversation with you is because I had written a manuscript, and through talking with different people, I ended up being connected with a retired Methodist pastor here in town who had been the head pastor for one of the largest churches here in my area. And we got to have this great conversation, and it was recommended that I talk to him, like I said, through this series of other connections that I had. And we started to talk about this idea of social justice, because in this manuscript, that term was in the subtitle. Mm-hmm. And he just said, "I really caution you." Mm-hmm. And I was naive and uneducated to that and didn't understand the caution, because I thought justice is a good thing. But I think he was seeing, in a nutshell, what you're seeing, which is it's not that social justice is a bad thing, mm-hmm. but this was a book on with faith as the capstone. And so social justice really is an incomplete, even it's an incomplete term mm-hmm. for really what I meant was mm-hmm. what is God's heart for justice. But I will say, I also think that maybe some of the reason why that becomes a main dish or a lens or an idol down the road is not because people or believers necessarily want it to be that. I don't think that's their main goal. I think it's very intimidating for kind of this run of the mill, you know, weekend activist to say, "I know God's heart for justice." Like that's an intimidating concept, right? Like we want to do biblical justice. But so many of these things that we're dealing with, maybe we don't see directly in the Bible. Gosh, how do we do that? And I don't know. Do you have anything on that?
Well, yeah, it reminds me of a situation I was in recently where I think I realized that what was becoming the foundation or the cornerstone of a certain organization was no longer really the gospel, but actual social justice. And it was in that moment that I realized that this changes everything. And so here's what I mean by that. There was an organization that came to Waco that I had relationship with, and they do a lot of work over in the Middle East. And they have relationship with different churches. But as this organization was talking about how we have to get these people employed and we have to find safety and refuge for them, and we have to, you know, find places to really just at the end of the day, empower them, I realized there was absolutely no conversation occurring around the gospel, around giving them an opportunity for salvation.
Right.
And, you know, sort of spoke up about that. And I said, you know, I could empty my bank account right now and take care of probably one family for the next few years. Right. But then when I walk away, what have I really given them of eternal value? And the conversation after, you know, this meeting I was having with my pastor who was also there, and he said, I wholeheartedly believe that there is a call on the church to, you know, feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to take care of the widow, to take care of the orphan, to really love, again, on the least of these. And he said, however, I am not okay with sending people to hell, warm, well-fed, and sheltered. He's right. Like, that is not a complete picture of justice. If we really believe in biblical justice, then we understand that God's heart is to love these things, but the most loving thing that we can do is offer people that invitation into eternal life. Like this life is so temporal. And so I think that's where people get a little bit, you know, it gets sticky with social justice, because social justice is we're going to take care of society right here and right now, and we're going to take care of these social ills. And to that, I say yes and amen. But when all is said and done, have we given them anything of eternal value? Or have we done this with the Father heart of God in mind that says we are doing this because this is a testament to my goodness and my glory? And right. That I think is where biblical justice sort of consumes that social justice narrative and says, hey, it's more than that for the believer, for the church, you know, that we can't just take care of the here and now, because as Jesus says, the poor will always be with us.
Yes.
So that doesn't mean we don't engage them, but it means that when we do, we always keep this eternal perspective in mind. Right.
Oh, it's so good. It's yeah. so good. And I, as you were talking, I'm reminded there's an organization that my husband and I love, also in the Middle East, but called One for Israel. And, they, in Israel, it's, you know, it's slightly different situation than some of the other countries in the Middle East. For the vast majority, obviously there are settlements and this organization works within the settlements, but for the most part, it's not necessarily about feeding and clothing and employing and educating. And so it takes a slightly different viewpoint, but their motto for this ministry is the best way to bless Israel is with Jesus. And I just think, oh, if we could, when you were talking, I just kind of thought of that tagline and I'm like, what if that was our tagline for the quote social justice or the justice work that we do? What if that was our tagline? The best way to bless the homeless population around me is with Jesus. The best way to bless these, you know, victims and perpetrators of human trafficking is with Jesus. The best way to bless the people who are on the front lines of racial tension right now in our world is with Jesus. You know, I think, thank you. Again, that's like really empowering language for me to hear you when you tell that story, because I think that sometimes you're right. We get started off on the right track. And sometimes I think we think maybe, well, Jesus is kind of offensive sometimes, but giving a coat's not offensive or giving a meal's not offensive. We want to build a relationship. We want to do these things. And I think those things are all good. But we have to remember, like you're saying, the ultimate thing, the goal here is to make an eternal impact, and what we what we can do to make an eternal impact in these people's lives, which is blessing them with Jesus and with the gospel. Real quick, in our last few minutes, we've talked about this creation, fall, redemption, restoration narrative for the world. And you told me previously about kind of a litmus test for you when it comes to, I don't know if you would say when it comes to causes or when it comes to implementing justice. And I don't think it's a bad way to look at this. In fact, I think it's a very godly and biblical way to look at it. So can you talk about that, your litmus test, for just a minute?
Yeah. So, and I think I've referenced it just a little bit earlier, but it's this idea of saying, okay, I see brokenness. Where do I see a place for redemption and restoration? So I don't want to necessarily get into the weeds of any one particular issue, but there are some times when students will bring up in class a stance that they have on something in particular. And that is when, you know, with them or just even in my own life, I sort of, you know, take a step back and I say, do I see a place for redemption and restoration within this? So with anti-trafficking, for example, to me, it's just so obvious. I spoke in Dallas Theological Seminary's chapel, and somebody, and they could at the end, like, text in questions, and the moderator, you know, kind of asked me their questions. And one of the questions was, do you not ever grow wearier of this work? Or how is this not so hard? Or how, you know, just something along those lines. And absolutely, I can go into rabbit trails where I just feel so inundated by the oppression and the brokenness that I am reading that I just have to come up for air and take a little bit of a break. But mostly, I see the gospel in this. We see people who have, and most people don't just one day wake up and fall into trafficking. We look at these people and we realize these are vulnerable populations all along. These are the kids who are growing up in low socioeconomic status homes. These are the kids who are coming from broken backgrounds and situations. A lot of kids, male and female, particularly female, have been sexually abused in their past. And so a lot of the things that we've already had perspective and understanding about domestic abuse and child abuse and hunger and homelessness, these sort of things that we've had conversations, we recognize that those are all facets of brokenness that we find within human trafficking. But it's so easy for me to say, okay, there is an opportunity to offer counseling, and there's an opportunity for the church to kind of come in and provide safe housing for them, to bring meals. There was even a trafficking victim here in Waco that we ended up housing at a safe place, and part of the program required that she have a job. And it was complicated because you know, she had a background that prevented her from getting a job. And so what we did as the church is she ended up, you know, cleaning different houses for us, but we just sort of, you know, piecemealed together this network of people and said, okay, who has work for her to do? Wow. And so again, and that's another conversation, how work can be so redemptive. You know, before the fall, there was work and it was good. Yes. And so this place of redemption and restoration, and it's a journey, right? It doesn't always happen in that linear order. You know, sometimes there's more brokenness and more fall and more redemption and restoration take place. But if you look at a situation and you cannot see how there can be a place for that person to be redeemed, restored, reconciled to God, then it probably isn't biblical justice, right? Yeah. So again, you know, like I won't go into the weeds of, but that is when I'm looking at things like adoption, if I'm looking at things like abortion, if I'm looking at things like the death sentencing, that is the same worldview I'm applying, saying, okay, right. Lord. And so I won't go into my stance on all those, but I think for those listening to kind of say, okay, do I see an opportunity for redemption and restoration at the end of this narrative? Right. If not, it's probably not the Father Heart of God.
Right. It's so good. I think it's so good because I think we can get wrapped up in doing what we see as good and forgetting sometimes that God's thoughts are higher than our thoughts and his ways are higher than our ways. And he understands people better than we do because he created us. And so his ultimate goal is not necessarily, it's almost like parenting, right? It's like, yeah. I had some kids really mad at me this week in my house. But there's part of me that says, well, if they were really thrilled about everything I was doing at the moment, then I probably am not doing everything for their ultimate good. And yes. Sometimes it hurts us to abstain or to do something that we see, oh, this would be an immediately good thing, but to trust God's heart when he says his ultimate good is that everyone would come to know him. His yeah. ultimate good is that everyone would be restored in relationship with him. His ultimate good is that we would all be redeemed and take advantage of the salvation that he offers through Jesus. And so sometimes that doesn't line up with our human perspective of what might we think, quote, do good right now. Sometimes it means we have to take a long view, or sometimes it means we have to take a different view. But I think that starting point that you're talking about of restoration and redemption to God, what is that perspective will point us, if you will, maybe down the better fork in that road, and walk that way, as opposed to maybe what we're tempted to do. What I'm tempted to do sometimes is you just want to do something right now. You just want to do good right now and do this right now and what you see, but we have to trust God's Father heart, like you're saying, for what he sees. And, I think focusing on restoration and redemption, and gospel centered message is really not just appropriate. I think it's how we do well.
Yeah. It's essential.
It's essential. It's how we do well.
Yeah. And I would say just kind of two things, that I think are helpful when I'm talking in class that I share, is one, I tell my students, you know, you need to look at life, as a long book, a novel, and that you are part of a chapter. So we may not have the complete story and the complete picture, just like with scripture. I mean, if you camp out in the Old Testament, that is a pretty bleak message. You know, people talk a lot about like God of the Old Testament, God of the New Testament. It is the same God. Mm-hmm. It was just a different part of the story. And now that we have the entire Bible, we can see, okay, Genesis to Revelation, we understand that there's an entire narrative being written here that tells a more complete story. And so even with our own life, like we are part of a chapter, that this is not the complete story. So what do you need to do with your words and your time and your space to be part of the right story? But keep in mind that you are probably, you in and of yourself, you're a vapor and you're here now, and it is not the complete story. Right. And then another thing I tell my students when we're talking again about worldview, and this doesn't necessarily pertain to justice, but I have found it to be a really powerful illustration when helping my students understand why worldview matters so much, that the lens through which you see life will affect everything you do, everything you see, every way you act. When my husband and I were wanting to start a family, we had a 4-year journey of infertility, and we could not find anything wrong with us. Doctors could not find anything wrong, but we went through the entire gamut of testing, all the way to infertility treatment, to IVF, even so as far as like having to freeze our eggs and then, you know, thaw them and plant them again. So it was a long, expensive, arduous, heartbreaking journey. And when we finally conceived, I remember we were at the doctor's office and everything looked great, the initial ultrasounds, and there was a heartbeat. And we went back for about the 12-week appointment, and there was no more heartbeat. Mm. And we were absolutely devastated. We were crushed. And my doctor, who was not a believer, said to me in his attempt to comfort me, he said, "Oh, Christina, you don't want that baby. There is something wrong with that baby." And I realized it in retrospect, not in the moment, but in retrospect, that he was looking at life through more of a scientific, Darwinistic, survival of the fittest worldview. And that is so antithetical on most levels to God's gospel-centered worldview, which would say, of course I wanted this baby because my goal is not perfection. My goal is to love well and to steward well what the Lord has given me and to bring to that place of what would perhaps be brokenness if that baby had made it, if there was something genetically wrong, to a full picture of this is what the gospel does. Because at the end of the day, we are all broken, every single one of us. We are all vulnerable, right? And so it's the gospel that comes in and it makes up for that gap. Some of us may be broken at 50%. Some of us may be broken at 75%, but we are all in need of the gospel to fill that place. And there's that place of humility that recognizes this. And so then you can no longer go into a cause and say, I have the answer. You have part of the answer, but God has the full answer. So anyway, I know my students are always, you know, they're so young. They're like 19, 20, and they're like jaws drop because they're just trying to like reconcile what I just shared with them. But I'm always so hopeful that that will give a shift in perspective, that if you approach life from whatever worldview you're coming from, it's going to affect the way that you interact with people, the causes that you love, the justice that you do or don't do. And that a Christian worldview response would have responded to that place of miscarriage so differently.
Right. Oh my goodness. Thank you, Christina, for sharing that, tender place in your heart. But it is so important. It is so important for, and that speaks to me to say it, even if the person who you're responding to doesn't understand, having a gospel-centered worldview when you respond is compassion.
Yeah. Right?
It is. It's not, I'm sorry that that's not what you received, but we can be that for someone else who may not even know what they're receiving at that moment, but it feels like compassion and it feels like love, and it feels like what Jesus would do.
Yeah.
How he would respond. Right. And we want that to be, we want that to be our response. So, man, thank you so much for sharing that. That is really tender, but I do agree with you that it's very important, and that it helps us when we look at that as a
framework. Yeah, I think it's a framework.
So good. Yeah, it's so good. Thank you so much. So, oh my goodness, with that, I love it. We are out of time, but can you tell us, for people who want to learn more, how they can find you, how they could connect with your work, and kind of continue this conversation through some of your media?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Instagram, Christina_Crenshaw. I'm on Twitter, but I'm not very active. Twitter kind of stresses me out. Honestly, I get on and I'm like, I'm done. 10 seconds. I'm done.
I actually just got on Twitter. I'm like, I think I put in my bio, I don't have any intention to say anything. I just want to read. Cause sometimes the trending hashtags are a little bit quicker. You know, it's kind of quick and dirty and you can read them on Twitter. Yeah. So that's where my husband lives. But yeah, I don't live there yet.
And you know, I have a website, ChristinaCrenshaw.com. But I would say I would really want to leave people, you know, I would love for people to find me and engage, but I want to leave people with a few book recommendations and a few websites to go to. So a few books that are justice-centered and do integrate faith. Just Mercy, Bryan Stevenson. It's The Incarceration. Incredible. It's a movie too, if people want to just sort of like get the Cliff Notes version, but books are always better.
Oh, read it. So good.
Race Matters, Cornel West. It's not as much a faith-integrated book, but I think it gives language around racial tensions. And he is a believer. I've only ever read Race Matters, but I have heard him speak in person a number of times. He's come to Baylor and spoken, and I'm always very impressed with him. A Faith Perspective on Human Trafficking, Vulnerable by Raleigh Sadler. I'm a huge fan of all things Timothy Keller, specifically Generous Justice, which is, again, that sort of gospel call to engaging justice. Tim Dearborn is another great person who looks at, sort of what is the gospel perspective on injustice. And I just finished a fellowship with Dallas Theological Seminary, and the technical title that I had was a Cultural Engagement and Leadership Fellow through their Hendricks Center. But if you go to Dallas Theological Seminary and you look up the Hendricks Center, there's a whole website of resources on cultural engagement, which I think one could argue is a place of doing justice. It's okay, here's culture, places where we see God, where we don't, you know, whatever, but what is sort of like that biblical place of responding. So they've got great podcasts. I've done two of them for them. They have great books, great links. And there's a number of other resources I could say. But what I love about that website is it's curated a lot of what I could just throw out for people. So it's a good, amazing, easy landing spot.
Amazing. And so for everyone listening, I will put the links and the list of everything that Christina just shared in the notes for this episode so that you don't have to feel like you've got to grab your notes on your iPhone and try and get all of that down. So we'll put all of that, we'll put links there. I actually have just, my task list today is to order a new bookshelf for my office. And so thank you for filling up half of it before I even... get there. I own Just Mercy, but that is actually the only one of those books that you mentioned that I have read. And so I'm just so excited. Books are my love language. So I'm really excited to get started on that, but I'll put all of that in the show notes. So, and follow Christina. I follow her on Instagram. She's a joy. It's not all human trafficking, although there's definitely some of that, but we have stray kittens that are super cute and
feral kittens and feral kids.
Yeah, that's right. We talked about our feral kindergartners earlier. We've each got one.
Yeah. Mostly I would say my Instagram is a place of motherhood. If you are a mother who is listening, I think it's relatable in that sense.
Yes.
Navigating motherhood and work and
Yes, I definitely felt connected to you in that sense, especially since you have boys, because I have two boys as well. And I'm like, whoo, these are different animals. I'll just tell you that right now. So anyway, thank you so much, Christina. We'll talk soon.
Yes.
So thank you again so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Share the link with your friends. You can visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com. And until next time, this is Alexis Busetti, remembering to do well for ourselves so we can do good for others. Bye.